This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome back to the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello, a writer and researcher at MLB.com, joined by MLB.com national content editor Matt Myers. Today is Thursday, January 6th, 2022. Matt, Happy New Year. Happy New Year to our producer, Ryan Wallerson, and to all of you who are out here listening. There obviously hasn't been a ton going on in the baseball world, but the thing that keeps coming up is the Hall of Fame ballot. And that's because all of the Hall of Fame ballots from all the writers were due at the end of last year, by December 31st. And as the days go on, some writers are telling us who they voted for. Sometimes you have outlets like The Athletic doing like a whole news dump of six or seven ballots. And of course, our good friend Ryan Thibodeau is tracking them all on his tracker, so you kind of get a good idea, like there's some data behind it, of who's trending well and who's not trending well. Last year, writers did not induct anybody. It is possible that might happen again, although, of course, we will have six names in, not through the writers, but through the era committees that we talked about a couple weeks ago, the Negro Leaguers and Antonio Oliva and Jim Pat and those guys. What we're going to do today is we are going to kind of look at some of the names in the middle of the ballot. If you think about it, there are 30 names on the ballot, right? There's a couple of huge names at the very top who obviously should be in if you're just looking at on the field. Off the field controversy is going to keep some of those guys out. At the bottom of the ballot, you've got some guys who have really good careers but are just not going to get into the Hall of Fame. You know, like AJ Pierzynski, Ryan Howard, there's like 14 of those guys. And in that sweet, juicy, interesting spot in the middle, you have nine names that stand out to Matt and I. So we are going to go and kind of break down each of those nine. But Matt, before we do that, are we going to have anybody inducted this year, or is it another shutout?
I think we'll have at least one inducted by the BBWA. As you mentioned, there are six names going in. The full list is Tony Oliva, Buck O'Neill, Jim Cott, Minnie Minoso, Gil Hodges, and Bud Fowler. So there will be a robust ceremony at Cooperstown no matter what this summer. The question is whether or not anyone is going to get in through, you know, the front door, being the BBWA ballot, I guess, is how it might be termed. I don't know if that's the right way to phrase it, but it certainly, I guess, is considered to be a little more prestigious to be voted in that manner. I do think, and we can talk more about this as this goes on, I do think David Ortiz will get elected and will be the only person elected. Yeah. But, you know, I'm not certain about that. And I guess we'll find out in a couple of weeks. January 25th, right, is when it's going to be announced.
Yes, there is like one interesting little quirk that I think most people aren't really thinking about enough. So the big names at the top of the ballot, a couple of them are in their 10th and final year, right? Barry Bonds, Curt Schilling, Roger Clemens, Sammy Sosa. You all know their stories right now. It's no point in delving into why they haven't been in yet. But I think for a lot of people, they're so exhausted by that conversation and they assume, well, this is their 10th and final year. Probably none of them are getting in. And then we want to think about this for a while. Except if you think about the way that the Hall of Fame works, every single year, the writers vote. And then there's also been various versions of, used to be called old timers committees, veterans committees. Now they're called era committees, right? There's four different eras of baseball, the six names Matt just mentioned, that's how they already got voted for this year. And it turns out, if you look at the schedule for next year, the era that will be voted on is the today's game, and that is 1988 to present. Guess who starred for 1988 to present? Those dudes. Now, let me preface this by saying, I don't think a small group of, I think it's 16 Hall of Famers and historians and old-time writers, I don't think those guys are going to look at these guys any more favorably than the writers have. So I'm not saying that in 10 months from now, Barry Bonds and Curt Schilling are Hall of Famers, but they might be on that ballot. And you might be going through this again from a different point of view with different people. And I just think not enough people have really noticed that, because it's going to come out and just shock them in When does that ballot even get named? Like October? I think it's not that far away.
Yeah, no, it's. I think it comes out right after the season or during the postseason, and then they vote on it during the winter meetings, and it's announced during, or what's normally the winter meetings, I should say, early December. What will be interesting to me is to see how they fare percentage-wise compared to the BBWA ballot. Right now, here's the thing, as always, a good reminder, what often happens is that the people who publicize their ballots often vote for more players. So generally speaking, whatever you see in the public ballots lop off anywhere from like 5 to 10 percentage points, because as like the people who don't reveal their ballots are often just tend to be, for any number of reasons, more quote unquote small hall voters. So yes, right now Barry Bonds is at 81% on the public tracker, and Roger Clemens is at 79%. They're somehow people who vote for one and not the other, which I'll never understand.
I can explain that. There was one voter who looked at, Clemens has had some other issues with young women, and I think that was a turnoff for
the voter. Got it. Well, that's totally reasonable, and this will come up again, unfortunately, as we talk more about some of these candidates on the ballot this year. But anyway, I think, I still actually think Bonds and Clemens will end up doing better than they have done in recent years. Last year, they both were at like 62%. My guess is they get a 10th year bump and end up in like the 65 to 70% range, because that often happens. Players in their 10th year just... people decide that they want to vote for him. It's often put players over the top. It happened with Tim Raines. I think it happened. Was Edgar Martinez getting his last year, second to last year? I can't remember.
I think so, yeah.
So I think we'll see that, but I think they're gonna fall short. The counter argument I'll make is that right now David Ortiz is at 82.6%. So going by that, he's going to be right at the border. However, I do think David Ortiz checks the boxes of a lot of sort of more quote unquote traditional voters, of like, the it factor, the feel factor, less stat based and more about like, oh, this player had an important place in baseball history. So I do think he'll maintain a little bit better and just get in over the line. That's just my gut feeling, but I think it's going to be close.
Yeah, I have numbers from 2 years ago. So 2 years ago, among the ballots that were made public, Roger Clemens got 64% on those. Among the ballots that were not made public, 46%. And it's pretty easy to explain why. The writers who tend to publicize their votes lean towards maybe a little more progressive, a little younger. I think some of the older school, more traditional ones choose not to. That happens like every single year. But I am kind of excited. I was like sort of joking that nobody will expect them to be potentially on this ERA committee later. And there's a small part of me that hopes they make it onto the ballot and then don't make it in. And it's not because I don't think they should be Hall of Famers. I mostly do think they should be. But because people hate the writers voting for the Hall of Fame. And I should point out, Matt and I are both members of the BBWA, so let's not pretend we have no skin in the game here. We're not Hall of Fame voters yet. Except the people who think that, like, if you just let former players vote, then all of these guys would be in are nuts. Like, players aren't going to vote for these guys either. You know who would get in this year if it was just players voting for the Hall of Fame? Omar Vizquel and Kurt Schilling. That would be the Hall of Fame ballot. I guarantee it.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. I think, it's when they do these ERA committees, it's a 16-person committee of, former mix of writers, executive, former players. And, I'm curious to see, granted, it's a very small sample, but like, assuming that Bonds and Clemens, for example, are in the 65 to 70% range, with the writers this year, are they going to get 10 out of 16? I could see them getting like 3 out of 16. Very interested to see how, like, more of their quote unquote former peers view them. But anyway, I think we should move on to talking about sort of like the juicy middle we discussed, the guys who maybe on paper aren't as good candidates, but maybe have more interesting cases, because we're just talking about, like, we don't have to worry about any of the off-field stuff for the most part. We're just talking about like them as baseball players and traditional Hall of Fame standards.
Yeah. So we're going to get to 9 interesting names. I just want to briefly mention some of the guys who are currently polling at under 10% on the tracker and have no chance to get in, because listen, if you even get on the list here, you've had an amazingly good career. Right. So here's the thing that I've noticed about some of these names, Matt, and since we're about the same age, I'm interested to know if you feel the same way. It's like Justin Morneau, Prince Fielder, Jake Peavy, Jonathan Papelbon, Mark Teixeira, like these kind of guys, great careers, are not going to get into the Hall of Fame. And I've started to notice that this year, maybe last year, is the first time that I look at the ballot and I say, man, I remember every part of this guy's career. I remember them being drafted. I remember them coming up. It's not like, maybe not the guys at the top, because I was, 5 when Roger Clemens made his debut, But man, I remember Torii Hunter coming up. I remember Tim Lincecum coming up. I don't like this. I think you're probably in the same boat.
There are players on this ballot I covered, interviewed when they were minor leaguers. That's
it's so, not.
Yeah, I remember interviewing Justin Morneau as a wide-eyed rookie in either the Yankee Stadium or Shea Stadium locker room. So I'm with you. I'm pretty sure I saw Ryan Howard play in AAA. Of this group that you mentioned, who would you think has the most compelling? So did you mention all the names?
No, yes. I didn't. Here's our 14 names here. Mark Burley, Tim Hudson, Torii Hunter, Tim Lincecum, Joe Nathan, Jonathan Papelbon, Mark Teixeira, Ryan Howard, Justin Morneau, Carl Crawford, Prince Fielder, Jake Peavy, AJ Pierzynski, and Omar Vizquel, who is kind of in a class of his own. His support is totally cratering. Matt and I believe neither of us think he's a Hall of Famer just on the baseball merits, so the rest of it doesn't really matter. Of that group, I think Joe Nathan, not necessarily because I think he belongs, but because I would probably vote for Billy Wagner, and I can't make a terribly compelling difference between the two of them.
I think there are three people of this group that quote unquote stand out as possible. And they sort of speak to, like, I think Joe Nathan, for that reason you mentioned, is sort of like, if we're letting in relief pitchers, like, he's one of the 10 best relief pitchers ever, you know, maybe not quite, but like he's on par with the other relief pitch or better than the other relief pitchers that are in the Hall of Fame. So basically, like, this is a good segue for me, because basically I think there's kind of like, and I'll speak to a couple of other of these guys as part of this. I kind of think that there are sort of three ways of looking at the Hall of Fame ballot, right? Like the established standard. Number one is like established standard. It's like, is this player, based on their numbers, as good or better than other players in the Hall? You know, would he, if you admitted him, lower the bar for his position, right? I think that if you really believe in this method, you are by default kind of a big Hall kind of person, but we'll get there. Just we'll get to that in a second. The second way I think of looking at it is sort of like, and mind you, none of the guys in that group, I think, fit the quote-unquote established standards, unless you're talking about relief pitchers. Number two would be sort of like the, can you tell the baseball history, the story of baseball history without this person, right? And I think that, like, you know, like, or like, is it hard to, like, is admitting them sort of like missing part of the game? And the one person I think sort of like fits that bill of that group would be Tim Lincecum. But I think that his career was just too short to sort of like, his peak was just too short to even cross the line, but but like he had that like really brief period where he was like in some ways the brightest star in baseball, the most interesting player in baseball, won consecutive Cy Young awards, but he was basically done as a dominant pitcher after like his fourth or fifth season in the league. That's how you know, sort of fast and bright it was. And then the third way is sort of like, you know, your own standards, which I think is kind of like a combination of the two, of just like, how do you view the established standards versus like the baseball history it factor thing, and how you kind of bridge those things together. The other guy on that list, I think, kind of maybe merits discussion is Mark Burley, just because of his longevity, his consistency, perfect game, keep, you know, star pitcher on a World Series team, also pitched a no-hitter separately, but again, I don't think he quite gets there.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we will come back and look at our 9 interesting in-the-middle names for the Hall of Fame ballot this year. Welcome back to the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions podcast. Mike Petriello and Matt Myers. We are going to spend this segment looking at 7 of the interesting hitters who have a decent shot at making the Hall of Fame this year. The first name on this list is Bobby Abreu, and I don't know if you have like a guy on the ballot each year that you would kind of go for the mat over. For me, it's Bobby Abreu. He was underappreciated in his time. It feels weird saying that because he retired like 7 years ago. But I don't know. I found it weird that Bobby Abreu didn't get more play when he was around. So 2 All-Star games, 1 top 15 MVP finish. And, you know, when I look at his career, he had a lot of like the traditional metrics, like a career 291 batting average. He hit 288 home runs. He stole 400 bases. Listen to this. There are only 6 players in baseball history with a career of at least 250 homers and 400 stolen bases, right? 3 of them are in the Hall of Fame. Ricky Henderson, Joe Morgan, Craig Biggio. Barry Bonds obviously belongs. Bobby Bonds, his father, was like a quietly great player in his day. And Bobby Abreu, if you were to look at Bobby Abreu and you compare him to Tony Gwynn, the difference is batting average. You could make a credible case that they had the exact same career. Like the on-base percentage is almost identical. Slugging is almost identical. Abreu had way more homers, more stolen bases, just didn't have the same batting average. And Tony Gwynn was like an inner circle first time, no doubt about it. I would go to the mat for Bobby Abreu.
I mean, Mike, you're kind of stealing my guy. Like, Bobby Abreu's like been my guy for years. So like, you're preaching to the choir. I think my feeling about him is honestly, like, I'm not even sure he's a Hall of Famer, but I think it's weird to see that like Scott Rolen, Todd Helton, and Andrew Jones polling so much better than him. That's what I don't really get. But I think there's something like, I think he came around a little too early. He came of age just when, you know, kind of like Moneyball came out and people really started valuing, you know, on base percentage and sort of, you know, stolen base efficiency and things like that. But especially by the end of his career, his outfield defense was much maligned. But like some of his numbers and like his showings on MVP votes are like bizarre. He had one year where he hit 308, 413, 521 with 50 doubles, 20 homers, and 31 steals and did not appear on a single MVP ballot.
That's what I was saying when I was like, it's not like he played that long ago. If you told me that in 1952, I get it totally. 2002 wasn't that long ago.
He had, you know, there's been four seasons in baseball history where a player has gone over 300 batting average, 400 on base, 500 slugging with 30 homers and 40 stolen bases. It's happened just four times. Barry Bonds did it twice. Vlad Guerrero did it once in a season in which he got caught stealing 20 times. And Bobby Abreu did it when he went 40 for 45 in stolen bases. Again, like, I'm not saying he's definitely Hall of Famer, but I feel it's strange that like, I think that he's very much in the same class as his case is very sort of similar to me as Rolen, Helton, and Andrew Jones. And like, yet you look at the tracker and Abreu is at like 12% and Jones is around 50%. Rolen is at, you know, 70%. And who's the other person I mentioned?
Helton.
Helton is at 55%. Like, that's sort of what I don't get. I'm not just saying I go to that. And that's one of the things that's tricky as a voter, right? Because of the 10 person. Right. Limit, and this we'll get to when we kind of give our fake ballots, is like, wouldn't know what to do with Abreu. Like, part of me would feel like compelled to vote for him just to sort of keep him on the ballot and give him a chance to sort of get this is when people talk about like, oh well, like, you don't need 10 years because like if you're not a Hall of Famer, people should be able to, you know, figure that out within a year or two. But because of the ballot limit and this like backlog, which is going to get cleared a little bit this year, he actually really hasn't gotten I almost feel like he hasn't gotten a fair shot to be vetted.
I'm sure I've said this before, but I despise the 10 ballot maximum so much. Who's the weakest candidate on this ballot? Maybe Ryan Howard, right? Ryan Howard had a really good career, and you should be able to evaluate him just based on that, not based on whether 10 other guys. But I think you're right. Abreu is probably like the 12th best guy on a lot of people's ballots. The last one thing on him, and I saw this from David Laurel of Fangraphs, and it requires a little bit of context, but did you realize that Bobby Abreu had two additional wins above replacement than Ichiro Suzuki did? And neither one of us are just like listing the WAR and voting off of that. And that obviously doesn't account for Ichiro's time in Japan. So like context, but still, Ichiro is going to be like first ballot 98% kind of guy. I'm with you. And I just hope Abreu gets the 5%, which I think he will. And then we can continue pushing for him year over year. All right, the next guy on our ballot, Todd Helton. Todd Helton, 17 years, 5 All-Star games, 3 top 10 MVP ballots. Listen, as most of you know, I grew up a Dodger fan, which means I spent a lot of years watching Dodger-Rockies games, and almost all of those games up until the last few years were announced by the legendary Vin Scully. And if I could count how many times Vin Scully mentioned that Todd Helton played quarterback at Tennessee and it was his injury that opened the door for Peyton Manning, the thousands at least. And hey, listen, you're Vin, you're by yourself. You got to rely on the stories you know. But it became like a running joke among Dodger fans. Hey, did you know he played quarterback at Tennessee? Here's the thing I think helps Todd Helton a lot. And that is that Larry Walker already got in, right? Because like the thing I think people look at when they look at Todd Helton is like, okay, well, not only did he play at Coors, but he played at pre-humidor Coors, which is like playing baseball on the surface of the sun. And hey, there's no doubt he was better, you know, at home, a 999 OPS at home, 833 OPS on the road. But I want to point out one thing to you here. His 2000 season was unbelievably good, right? 372, best average in baseball, 463, best on base percentage, 698, best slugging percentage, right? And you're probably thinking to yourself, well, yeah, okay, but 2000 course. At home that year, he had an OPS of 1242. On the road that year, 1074. on the road, away from Coors, he slugged 633. And then the other argument I would make is, we have a lot of park-adjusted stats these days. OPS Plus is park-adjusted. WAR is park-adjusted. I don't think his case is as strong as Walker's, but I think it's a better case than people are giving him credit for.
I think he'd be a no for me. I think he really kind of stopped hitting. His like home run totals went way down. So like at a certain point, like he ended up with 369 homers, which is like kind of an underwhelming number for a corner guy, especially when playing in Coors Field. I just feel like there's not quite enough there. Again, I mean, one thing I will say, and you know, Mike, you wrote a piece about this last year, building off a piece that Dave Cameron wrote on FanGraphs, you know, maybe like 10 years ago, basically saying like, we're not really voting enough guys into the Hall of Fame. That basically, if you go by history, we've basically like really sort of made it a smaller and smaller hall as time has gone on. And that's one thing I wrestle with when it's sort of like, if we go by like, you know, if we agree that we should be always be admitting like the top 1 to 2% of players of all time, which I think you wrote in the piece, like probably all these guys are worthy of admission. If I'm thinking of like my own personal standards of what I think it should be and what it should have been all along, Helton falls a little short for me.
That's fair. He's a better player than Gil Hodges, though. So I guess he's just going to have to go lead like the 2029 Pirates to an unexpected World Series.
That kind of goes back into the, and that goes, you know, to the, like, sort of like the, you know, place in baseball history conversation, which is obviously like a big sort of soft factor kind of thing, which I think that, you know, even as someone who's a, you know, a Bob Abreu supporter, he definitely fails on that test. Like Bob Abreu is not like a key member of a key component of baseball history. You can certainly tell the story of baseball history without Bob Abreu, but Gil Hodges does occupy this space in baseball history because he played for this legendary team and was the manager of this legendary team. Like that matters. No,
I mean, Bobby Abreu played an important role in allowing me to write like 15 articles about the home run derby curse because it totally fell apart after he won it that year. I think more of Helton than you do, but I see your point. All right, our third hitter here, Andre Drones, who's a really interesting case. 17 seasons, 5 All-Star games, 10 straight Gold Gloves, 7 different 30 home run seasons. On the surface, he's a tough one for me because, like, you could just say, okay, listen, 434 home runs from maybe the best ever defensive center fielder, or at least in that conversation, like that should be enough. Jay Jaffe, who I should say I pulled a lot of this information from FanGraphs, he wrote, from 1998 to 2006, only Alex Rodriguez and Barry Bonds were more valuable than Andre Drones. That's really good. Here's the flip side of this for me. His overall 111 OPS plus is just okay. Like, it's 10% better than average. And he was completely cooked by the end of his 20s, right? Through age 29, 342 home runs, 116 OPS plus. After that, 92 homers, 92 OPS plus. I don't care that much about hits totals, but he didn't even get to 2000. I think like a 254 batting average is going to hurt him in a lot of ways. And I'm also going to admit my own personal bias here. As I said before, grew up a Dodger fan. Well, in 2008, the Dodgers gave him 2 years and $36 million. I showed up overweight, hurt his knee, hit .154 in 75 games, and they just cut him. They let him go. He has also been accused of domestic violence, unfortunately, off the field, which certainly does not aid his case. How do you weigh a guy who was amazing in his 20s and then just did like nothing after that?
If you went strictly on the field, I actually would probably lean yes on him for the two reasons I mentioned before of we probably aren't letting enough players into the Hall of Fame. And I think he sort of is a key part of baseball history. Like when he came up, he was like a true phenom. He was, by the eye test and by the metrics available at the time, the best center fielder for like 10 years. It was like this one, it was cool because it was like this one player who like, this wasn't like a Jim Edmonds thing where like he had these amazing acrobatic catches, but like every metric available was like, yeah, he's not that good. Andre Drones was like acrobatic. He was smooth. And the numbers available at the time were like, oh yeah, this guy's the best there is. So for those reasons, and also like, I think he also gets a bonus for me, like from the baseball history sort of aspect, he was the first superstar from Curacao, which has since become like a hotbed of baseball talent. Like there's something cool there as well of like being this trailblazer from a different country. So from that standpoint, he's in for me. Now, the domestic violence thing is actually tricky. And I think this is one of the things that I would really have a hard time with as a voter when I do become a voter, because like, I know there's some people who say, oh, the Hall of Fame, it's a museum, it should honor baseball history with all the warts. Like being elected for a plaque for the plaque room is an honor. It is an honor, and we make decisions on who we choose to honor, right? And like, you know, the situation ended up with he was charged, the charges were dropped, but he ended up getting like serving probation. It was like, it was messy. But the thing is, it happened right after his major league career ended, and he hadn't been a good player for years. So I think it kind of like got ignored because like no one really cared about him as a baseball player anymore. He actually went on to play 2 more years in Japan, which I had totally forgotten about. He's one that like would be, if we're talking baseball, he's a yes for me. But like, if I was actually had to check the box, I'm not sure what I would do.
Yeah, he is definitely a tricky one in that way. If you're going back to like his place in baseball history, this is true at the time. I think this is still true, but I guess I'm not 100% sure. He was the youngest player to ever homer in a World Series game. He was 19 years old when he came up and hit 2 home runs in 1996. I agree with you. The off-field stuff and the total collapse in the second half of his career make it a tough one for me.
Would he have been better off if he just had a career-ending injury when he was 30? Like you know, yes. Granted, I mean, Kirby Puckett was 35. He debuted a lot later. Kirby Puckett debuted at 35, but basically his career was over at 35. He had one, you know, he was great at his age 35 season, and then he had an eye issue that ended his career. He ended up in the Hall of Fame, but his counting stats are, you know, his number by the, like, you know, like he ended up getting in. He also had off field stuff, but we won't get into that. But like,
well, you're talking about Ichiro, right? Ichiro was great until he was 34, and then he played like 8 more lousy years. No, I mean, I agree with you. Let's move on to Jeff Kent here, right? Jeff Kent. Another tricky one, 17 years in the bigs, 5 All-Star games, the 2000 MVP. I always remember him for like having that real I'm an extra in an 80s cop movie mustache, you know, just like peak mustache, but not like the big bushy Raleigh Fingers mustache, just the like I'm, you know, the third extra in a Police Academy movie mustache. He's interesting to me because he got off to sort of a late start in terms of being a good player. Drafted by the Blue Jays. Was traded, I believe, in the David Cone trade to the Mets. Had some good, not great seasons there. And for Cleveland, his first great year was in San Francisco. He's already 29 years old. I think for a lot of people, his case starts and ends with he has the most home runs by a second baseman in baseball history. And I think that's an easy one to say. Like, hey, nobody at your position ever hit more homers. You should be a Hall of Fame. Defense was not great. And, well, I have 2 questions for you here, Matt. First one is, is Chase Utley a slam dunk Hall of Famer for you?
I mean, Chase Utley sort of is kind of like Abreu, because I think he's one of those players who is subtly greater than people realized. And like, he's another guy that I would probably say, like, you know what? This guy was, I do think he's an all-time great player. And I think Chase Utley was a better player than Jeff Kent. But it's, you know, our old colleague, T.R. Sullivan, used to say, like, can you make the player's Hall of Fame case? Or I'm sure he still says it. Can you make their case in one sentence? And that's the thing. Jeff Kent, as you said, you can make his case in one sentence. Most home runs ever by second baseman. Boom. That's a very compelling case.
Yeah. Oh, I asked because Utley has about the same wins above replacement as Kent. And I think he's got a good case, but not a slam dunk case. Here's my other question for you. So he went to San Francisco, and that's really where he made his name, right? Like, if he gets in, it'll be with the Giants hat, probably. And he famously hated Barry Bonds. Like, they did not get along at all. But here's what I think is interesting. And maybe many other statistically oriented writers have generally looked down on the idea of lineup protection, that the idea that someone great hitting behind you gets you better pitches, just not true. But I've always been interested in the idea of reverse lineup protection. So he goes there and he's hitting behind Barry Bonds when Barry Bonds is like all-time greatest hitter who ever walked the planet, peak Barry Bonds, and is on base like 80% of the time. How many times do you think Jeff Kent came up with a man on base because Bonds had been walked? Now you're seeing fastballs. And his numbers in San Francisco were a lot better than anywhere else. I'm not saying that disqualifies him. It's just something that's always stood out to me as being like an interesting thing about his case.
And I could go both ways on him. You know, you mentioned Jay Jaffe before. He actually wrote a pretty compelling case against Kent, basically saying like his counting stats look good, especially for a second baseman. But when we look at defense and some of his rate stats, it really hurts his case a little bit. I'm kind of on the fence on him. I think if you go back to the, like, we really should be electing more players who played in the 90s and 2000s, like, he's probably in. And the most home runs ever for a second baseman thing is pretty compelling. But if I was just ranking players on the ballot, you know, he'd probably be like, I don't know, he'd be below Barreiro for me.
13th-ish.
Yeah, he'd be below Abreu.
Yeah, he would not be on my hypothetical ballot. All right, next name on our list is a really interesting one. David Ortiz, 20 years in the majors, 10 All-Star games, 3 rings, one of the greatest postseason performers of all time. If you like to put emphasis on the word fame in Hall of Fame, he's a hell of a lot more famous than Bobby Abreu, so I can tell you that. He was famously released by the Twins after his age 26 2002 season, where he hit 20 home runs with a 120 OPS plus. Again, was 2002 like 1902? I again got this quote from Jay Jaffe writing about him, and it makes my skin crawl. Though his pull happy approach provided plenty of pop, he drove Twins manager Tom Kelly crazy by refusing to focus on hitting the opposite field. He's David Ortiz. Are we trying to make him a spray hitter? In 2004, David Ortiz spoke to the Boston Globe and he said, "Whenever I took a big swing, they'd say to me, hey, what are you doing? So I said, you want me to hit like a little bleep? Well, then I will." Which, I don't know, maybe those early aughts Twins didn't quite have a modern focused game here. I always remember that Ortiz's final season, so 2016, he's 40 years old, 38 homers, OPS of over 1,000. He finished with 541 home runs. I think if he like wanted to hang on and play a couple years, he probably gets to 600 home runs. As it is, he ended with a 931 OPS at 947 just in the postseason. Some huge moments. Everybody in Boston will remember his speech after the Boston Marathon bombing. As I said, incredibly famous. There's two arguments I think you can make against him. One is that he was a DH. I don't think I care about that. DH has been a thing now for like 50 years. Stats account for it. Edgar Martinez is in. The other thing is that he was named on the 2003 survey testing for PEDs. Even the commissioner, even Rob Manfred, has said like that's pretty unreliable. Don't worry about that. And as far as I'm aware, Ortiz was never named, never suspected, never brought up, never failed anything else. Just that. I can't think of another good reason to keep him out aside for that suspicion being a DH. And that's neither one of those things are good enough for me.
Yeah, I mean, he passes the, you know, the, as you said, the fame, the baseball history. Can you tell the story of baseball history test with flying colors? And he was a dominant hitter until the day he retired. He's an easy yes for me.
Yeah, I was, how can you include him on a ballot but not include Barry Bonds? Like, I'm with you on that one. And also, I think out of everybody we've talked about so far, he is the one I want to see the speech of the most. Like, I feel like he would get up there and just rock Cooperstown. All right, we have two more hitters to get through here. Scott Rowland, who I think is maybe more so than Bobby Abreu, the stat head, you know, kind of cause this year. I think part of that is just because third base is a position historically underrepresented. There are, including Negro Leaguers, there are 17 third basemen in the Baseball Hall of Fame. That is the lowest of any position. You know, there's 25 first basemen, 22 second basemen, you know, dozens of outfielders. So I think that's part of it. 17 years, 7 All-Star games, 8 Gold Gloves, won the Rookie of the Year, won a ring. His case is basically that he was an incredibly talented defensive third baseman, and he was like consistently really good. It's a little bit of Adrian Beltre going on here, although I think Beltre is probably a better hitter. Rowland had 11 different seasons of 4 wins above replacement. And my feeling is, I think I would include him, but I just don't feel like it's as much of a slam dunk as a lot of like the super stat nerds tend to think. I think he's in, but I don't know that I feel like the Hall of Fame is less off if he's not, if that makes sense.
I'm with you on that. I feel like I lose a little bit of like my, like, you know, saber cred by not being as like, you know, excited about Rowland again. Like I've gotten soft my old age. I no longer like vocifer, you know, I used to get, you know, get involved in some of the you know, intense, there's no way Jack Morris should be in the Hall of Fame conversations. Like, I'm over that. I don't like vociferously argue against people. It's not worth it. Especially as I've said, I think that like there should be more modern players in. And so like if Rowland got in, I'd be like, oh, that's cool. Like that's like he's legitimate. Like there are many players who are currently in the Hall of Fame that he is as good or better than. Like he does not lower the bar in any way. But like he very much misses the fame thing. Like there's not like,
yeah,
a compelling thing about him is like he wasn't a charismatic player. He was super, you know, I mean, you could argue like, well, how could you argue for Bobby Abreu and not for Scott Rowland? Like, I could see, yes, you know, there's, in some ways their cases are sort of similar in that regard because they're subtle. I actually think his case is kind of similar to Andrew Jones, where like it's a defense first case. But I think that like for me, Andrew Jones like laps him in like the the other sort of like fame factors that I mentioned, putting aside the off field stuff. So I think that like from just looking at a baseball player, I'd actually put Andrew Jones ahead of him. And if you look at like, you know, the Jaws score, which is like the Jay Jaffe ranking system that's listed on Baseball Reference, they're super close, which compares like their WAR. I think it's like their WAR relative to the position that they play of Hall of Famers at their position. Like they're basically on the current this year's ballot, they rank 5 and 6. Roland and Andrew Jones rank 5 and 6 within like two points of each other. So they're super close. I think that like this is one of those where like if I was a voter and I was voting strategically, I'd probably put Abreu on my ballot instead of Roland just to make sure Abreu stayed on. But like I'm not sure. I still haven't like since I haven't ever had to fill out a ballot yet, you know, I'm not exactly sure.
The final hitter we'll get to before we take a break and talk about some pitchers is Jimmy Rollins, who I was surprised to read this when I looked this up before. The Phillies have been around forever. And did you realize he's played the second most games in Phillies history behind only Mike Schmidt? Like, I truly did not realize he'd been there for that long. 17 years, 3 All-Star games, 1 MVP, 1 ring. He played the 6th most games at shortstop all time. Like, again, I was stunned to see how consistently healthy and available he was for such a long time. He falls a little short to me on a lot of the offensive stats, right? I mean, listen, 470 stolen bases, 231 homers for shortstops, really good. But in 95 OPS plus, not that great. He was also kind of done by 30. From age 30 on, he had a 702 OPS. He actually only had one season, that 2007 where he won the MVP, where he had an OPS plus above 105. And he sort of feels like the kind of guy where the Phillies should absolutely retire his number and honor him as an all-time great Philly. But I think that's as far as it goes for me. I don't see him being honored in Cooperstown.
Yeah, I think that's well said. Like there are certain players that sort of are transcendent, especially within their franchise for one reason, for you know, certain reasons. He was an MVP. He was a key component of their World Series team. He was like, he played there forever, but he was never even the best player on his own team. Even the year he won MVP. I mean, that's the thing about the Phillies going back to Utley, right? Where this is going to hurt Utley's chances, but like there were consecutive years where Phillies won MVP, Ryan Howard and Jimmy Rollins, and Chase Utley was the best player on the team both years.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, even the year he won MVP, Rollins had a 344 OBP, which is not that high for an MVP. And he led the league. In fact, he led the league in outs made, which speaks to also just the fact that he was healthy and hit leadoff. It's kind of a fun, crazy fun fact. Jimmy Rollins led the league in outs made 4 times, but that he was incredibly durable and he batted leadoff. So there's some sort of self-fulfilling prophecy there, but he was never a high OBP guy. So I'm with you. He's a Phillies legend, an icon for that franchise, but not quite a Hall of Famer.
Yeah. And if you want to give any bonus points for just being like fun to watch, Jimmy Rollins was fun to watch. You know, I always got a kick out of watching him play. But he's not in any way on the top 10 of anybody's ballot here.
He is, and I want people should look this up. He is like the centerpiece of one of my favorite like internet, I don't know if it's a meme or like videos, or some Phillies fan like set the, you know, he had Rollins, I think, had that famous like game winning double against the Dodgers. You probably remember it in like the NLCS in like 2009.
Nope, no recollection of that.
I forget exactly what year it was, but someone set like
Broxton, I think.
Someone set the scene in Goodfellas where Ray Liotta's like listening to the radio in the shower when he learns about the heist.
Yeah,
and he starts screaming. Like he starts screaming, "Jimmy, Jimmy!" And someone like set that to the Jimmy Rollins double. It's pretty tremendous.
Well, now I'm sad. Now let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk about a couple pitchers in the juicy middle of the Hall of Fame ballot. We're back on the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions podcast. Mike Petriello, Matt Myers. We are going through some of the interesting guys on the middle of the Hall of Fame ballot this year. We just went through all the hitters. We're going to finish off by looking at a pair of pitchers. Then Matt and I will share our hypothetical ballots. Again, we'll each get real ballots in a couple of years. I can never remember what year it is. I think I'm like 4 more years out, and you're like a year or two after me on that. The two pitchers I want to talk about are Andy Pettitte and Billy Wagner. Andy Pettitte, 18 years in the majors, 3 All-Star games, won 5 rings as a big part of those legendary like Derek Jeter, Jorge Posada, late 90s Yankees. Went to Houston, was very good, ended up coming back to the Yankees. four different seasons, he finished in the top five in Cy Young voting, started 521 games. Here's the issue with him for me, and I think you can already tell I probably would not include him on my ballot. His biggest case is that he won a lot of games, 256 wins. A, I don't care about pitcher wins, and B, like, a lot of that was just not because of the team he played for. He had a 3.85 career ERA. So A, is that different from Burley, who's getting no support? And B, like, yeah, he's better than Jack Morris, but I don't think Jack Morris should be in. So he's another, like, hall of extremely good, but I don't see him in Cooperstown.
See, I'm actually a yes on Pettit. I've come around on this for a couple of reasons. One of which is, and you sort of compelled me to this point with the piece you wrote that I mentioned before, when you talked about how we're not electing enough players based on, you know, historical standards, and we're certainly not electing enough starting pitchers because we've totally forgotten how to manage starting pitchers now that no one wins 300 games anymore. So I think there's actually probably a whole class of pitchers from like the 80s, 90s, and till current day that probably should be in the Hall of Fame and are not. And, you know, a lot of people think Jack Morris lowered the bar, and like he probably did in some senses, but I also think it's more of like, you know, if Jack Morris is in, that's cool. Then probably Dave Steeb should be in, and David Cohn, and like a bunch of these other players,
Kevin Brown,
Kevin Brown for sure. You know, yeah. Johan Santana, like there's a whole other thing. And then like Andy Pettit, I think that, and you know, obviously he benefited by being like drafted by the Yankees when they're about to have a dynasty, but man, he was an incredible postseason pitcher. He has the most innings pitched in postseason pitched in baseball history. And yes, I know they expanded the playoffs, but it's now been like, you know, going on 30 years and it's still impressive. 58 more innings than any other pitcher, Tom Glavine. And he had, in 44 postseason starts, he had 28 quality starts, which is the most all time as well. So like the fact that he wasn't just like pitching a lot in the postseason, he actually pitched really well for a long time in the postseason. And that, for me, is what puts him over the top and differentiates him from someone like Mark Burley or Tim Hudson, for that matter, who also has pretty similar numbers.
I think you can make a much better case that Andy Pettit deserves to be in the Hall of Fame than you could that he deserves to be in the top 10 of this year's ballot. Like, I think he's another one of those guys where it's like, well, you're the 13th best player, so you're kind of out of luck. Have I mentioned how much I hate that maximum of 10? Have I mentioned that a couple of times? And the next pitcher here is Billy Wagner, who is another really interesting case because it comes down to how are we valuing relievers? 16 years, and really 15 because he like barely pitched, I think, one game that first year. Seven All-Star games. Yeah, 2.31 ERA, 12 strikeouts per nine. Never once led his league in saves, which is fine because I don't care about saves. He got lit up in the postseason a bunch of times. He's like the opposite of Andy Pettit. That should neither make nor break his case, but it certainly doesn't help him. He, another like kind of like Ortiz, he had an amazing final year. At 38 in 2010 for the Braves, he had a 1.43 ERA in 71 games, and he walked away. If you were to look at every pitcher in baseball history who threw at least 800 innings, his 33% strikeout rate is the highest ever. Granted, some of that's a little bit about the time in which he pitched. He wouldn't have done that in 1922 or whatever. But it sort of comes down to me is, are we thinking of Billy Wagner as a pitcher, or are we thinking about him as a relief pitcher? Because if you think about some of the other starters on this ballot who aren't going to get in, let's just like take out the Hall of Fame for a second. Let's say it's, I don't know, 2002, right in the middle of his career. And you were to say, hey, I have Billy Wagner, Oakland, will you trade me Tim Hudson for Billy Wagner? They would laugh at you. They would say, of course I wouldn't do that. Tim Hudson's going to throw me 210 very good innings this year. And I think that's the thing. I can't put him in if he's a pitcher. But if we are considering relief pitcher to be their own separate class, then he's arguably the best left-handed reliever ever, at least not including Aroldis Chapman, who's still pitching. Let me put it this way. I like Billy Wagner better than I like Trevor Hoffman because I don't care about saves. And Trevor Hoffman sailed it.
Yeah, it's tricky. You know, along your point about the Hudson, you know, the fictional trade, Joe Sheehan wrote a good piece about this comparing actually Andy Bennis to Trevor Hoffman because they were teammates on the Padres for a long time. And basically the point he made, like, Bennis was like the number one pick in the draft. It was basically in the big leagues a year later and a workhorse pitcher in the major leagues for like a dozen years who basically like was maybe not – he wasn't a superstar and he wasn't a disappointment. He was like, you know, a good pitcher, right? He was a good pitcher for a long time. And that basically like Trevor Hoffman was like a failed infielder who sort of like got backdoored into becoming a reliever, ended up being very good at it. But like there was never a point. And if you look at like how, you know, middle of the rotation starters are valued in free agency compared to relievers, like there was never a point where the baseball industry thought that like you know, Trevor Hoffman was a more valuable player than you know, someone like Andy Bettis. I mean, even now you see like middle of the rotation starters getting $80 to $100 million and relievers will never get that, right? So I think from that regard, I really wish some of these starting pitchers got in. But like if we're looking, if we sort of like almost create a separate reliever wing, like, yeah, I mean, Wagner, he had a, you know, lower ERA, ERA plus, WHIP, FIP than Trevor Hoffman. He had more Ks despite pitching fewer innings. That said, the postseason thing, man, it's, you kind of undersold how bad Billy Wagner was.
Not great.
13 runs allowed and 11 and two thirds innings pitched. And, you know, as a, speaking as a Mets fan, I will never forgive him for giving up a home run to Sou Taguchi in the ninth inning of game two of the 2006 NLCS. I think Billy Wagner is the, I know Carlos Beltran and Aaron Heilman are considered the goats of that series. To me, Billy Wagner, who was their big ticket free agent reliever, is the goat of that series. So, I remember vividly him giving up that home run to Sou Taguchi. It was a 6-6 game. He was brought in the top of the ninth. You know, I'm sure afterwards the conversation was like, well, that's what you get for bringing him into a non-save situation. Anyway, so he blows that game. They lose it. They had been winning early. It was a brutal loss for the Mets. And then in game six, I totally forgot, they brought him into the ninth inning. They were up 4-0, and he allowed two runs, including a two-run double to Sou Taguchi. Allowing the tying run to come to the plate in that series. He ended up, you know, getting the final out and they mercifully won 4-2. But his postseason resume, if you're arguing against Wagner, like that's it, where it's like at least like some of these great relievers. Now, granted, Hoffman doesn't have much of a leg to stand on there either. But I think that like one way that I think relievers, especially as baseball history goes on, can really separate themselves is with their postseason performance.
I think you just argued that Sou Taguchi should get some write-in votes for the Hall of Fame. You know what I think helps Wagner? Is he came up as a reliever. I believe he never started a game in his entire career. And then if you compare him to Joe Nathan, who I think has a pretty comparable case, maybe just like a tick behind, he came up as a starter. It wasn't a very good one. You know, he had two crappy years for the Giants as a starter where his ERA was nearly like 5. And then his career ERA as a reliever was 250, you know? So it's like, are you just looking at Joe Nathan as a reliever or are you taking his whole career into account? And if so, is it fair that Billy Wagner, who probably would not have been a very good starter, never was asked to start? You know, you sort of twist yourself into puzzles here. I would put Wagner in, but I would have a lot of questions about some of the other relievers I haven't put in yet. You know, it's like,
I might put Wagner in for the fact that he is a natural right-hander and like broke his arm and taught himself, yes, to throw left-handed and ended up throwing 100 miles an hour left-handed. That might be enough.
Yeah, that is it's an incredibly cool story. I think he actually broke his arm twice. Like it healed and then he rebroke it and spent the time learning to throw lefty, which is amazing. Okay, those are our guys we wanted to dig into. Matt and I are going to share some hypothetical ballots here. We are sadly going to stick to the 10-man limit, which I hate. I have 12 and a half guys I would put on my ballot because I'm sort of undecided about Joe Nathan and he's my half. He's on my maybe. Here's my 10. And this is alphabetical order. Number one, Bobby Abreu, obviously. And number two, Barry Bonds, because he's Barry Bonds. Number three, Roger Clemens, with a lot of discomfort because this non-PED part of his off-field career, it does not give me joy to vote for him, but I would. Todd Helton, number four. Andre Jones, number five. David Ortiz, number six. Scott Rowland, number seven. Gary Sheffield, who we didn't really end up talking about that much, I would put him in. Number eight, Sammy Sosa, nine. And Wagner, 10. Here's the thing. There are two other guys I would definitely vote for if I had the room to do it. Manny Ramirez, Alex Rodriguez. Their performance on the field speaks for themselves. I sort of draw the line a little bit because they did play in a time where they did break the rules and they did get suspended in ways that some of the other guys like Bonds and Clemens never did. And while that wouldn't cost my vote, it's enough to kick them to the back of the line, you know, under the 10-man thing. Again, I didn't say we can only vote for 10. That's not my stupid rule, but it is what it is.
So if you went up, did you have Curt Schilling on your fictional ballot?
I did not. He doesn't want us to vote for him, and I will be happy to oblige him.
All right. That was sort of how I treated him as well. I think that, like, you know, 5 years ago, if you had asked me, I would have said yes. But now, considering he's said, I need to vote for me, I'll take him off. I did not do as formal of a ballot as you did because I probably was not thinking quite as strategically as you were in terms of this group. And that's, so basically I have my six locks And one of them is a guy I don't even think you mentioned is like even on your top 13, which I think is interesting.
Who's that?
So my six locks would be, I would have Bonds, Clemens, Alex Rodriguez, David Ortiz, Manny Ramirez, and Sammy Sosa. I think Sosa very much is part of the, like, you cannot tell the story of baseball history without Sammy Sosa. I've always been a little disappointed by the lack of support he gets. I understand why he doesn't get it, but I think that, like, there was a time when he was as big of a star as there was in baseball. He hit 60 home runs three times. No one else has done it more than once. Like, it's a very soft factor case, but I think that, like, he's a unique case. So he would be a lock for me. I know the thing is, like, if I was voting and it was his 10th year on the ballot, would I actually vote for him knowing that he had no chance of getting in? That's sort of like where I'm not really sure how I would, you know, kind of go. If we're doing an up down vote, I give him an obvious yes. So that's like,
which guy did you think I didn't have?
Did you not have Sosa on your list?
I said Sosa. Yeah. He's on my list. Yeah.
Oh, I thought I could have sworn I missed it, man. Hearing comprehension is poor. So my six locks, Bonds, Clemens, A-Rod, Manny Ramirez, Sammy Sosa, David Ortiz. And then my next group of four, which I think would be the rest of my ballot, would be Pettit, Abreu, Sheffield, and Andrew Jones. But as I said, like, I'm not sure what I would actually do with Andrew Jones because some of his off-field stuff is similar to Clemens. And it's like, well, do I disqualify both? I don't know. When the time comes, this is what the kind of thing I'm going to struggle with is the idea that, like, this is an honor. We choose who we honor. Do we, like, by voting for them, I'm choosing to honor this person. Are they worthy of it? And that's kind of the question. And then I think I would have Roland and Helton as, like, my next two off.
So it sounds like, and I'm kind of doing this on the fly here, if we were not subject to limits, right, we would both have 12 or 13 names on the list. And the only player we, like, truly differ on is Andy Pettit, where you would say yes and I would say no. But otherwise, broad agreement, I think.
If it was an up-down vote, I would struggle with Wagner. I think I'd, like, up-down vote, I think I'd put Kent ahead of Wagner. If I'm just ranking my ballot and it's an up-down, that's the thing. It's like there's the different way to do it, right? Like, for me, for example, the reason I'd vote for Abreu over Roland, not because I'm convinced that he's a better player, but it's like Roland's definitely going to stay on the ballot and he's probably going to get in eventually. And I could probably vote for Roland next year once Bonds, Clemens, Sosa, and Schilling are off the ballot, right? I'll definitely have room for him on my ballot next year. Whereas like Abreu might fall off. So I'd be like, you know what? I'm going to vote for Abreu this year to make sure he stays on, knowing that like next year I'll have room to vote for Roland. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, next year, a lot of the logjam is going to go no matter what, just because the four guys we talked about.
Yes, exactly.
At year, it doesn't matter if they get voted in; they're off the ballot. You know,
exactly. That's sort of what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I think next year, I haven't looked at it that closely. I think the only guy coming online next year who's got like a really strong case is Carlos Beltran. Okay, I'm looking at it real quick. The other guys who obviously no ballot is out, but the names who may be new would be like Jared Weaver, Matt Cain, Coco Crisp. Does not seem like the strongest of new guys.
John Lackey, baby.
John Lackey, yeah. So I think Beltran will have a pretty strong case next year, but it's going to be so much easier because you're going to have those big, huge anchors at the top gone one way or the other. I have to say, Matt, the other day we were talking about what to do on the show, and you're like, let's talk about the Hall of Fame. And I'm like, oh, I don't know if I could do this anymore. And I actually really enjoyed
it's fun talking about the players where we could really just mostly focus on evaluating their careers as like baseball players. That's actually fun. It reminded me what baseball Hall of Fame ballots were, Hall of Fame debates were like, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
I'm looking forward to seeing who gets in. I think I agree with you. It'll just be David Ortiz and nobody else, which would be a pretty interesting slate of seven guys getting inducted into the Hall of Fame this upcoming summer. That will do it for this week's podcast. Don't miss an episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks for listening to the Ballpark Dimensions podcast. See you next week.